Welcome to Habitual Excellence, presented by Value Capture. This podcast and our firm is all about helping you and your organization achieve habitual excellence via one unifying focus, one value-based structure, and one performance system. In other words, it's about helping you capture dramatically more value through achieving perfect care and perfect safety for patients and staff. To learn more about Value Capture and our services, visit www.valuecapturellc.com.
Well, hi, welcome to Habitual Excellence. I'm Mark Graben, and we're joined today by Teresa Fry. She is the CEO and president of Sutter Valley Medical Foundation in California. Teresa, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Well, I'm glad you could join us. So I want to learn, you know, a little bit about your background, and maybe if you could first explain, there might be part of the audience who doesn't really understand the terminology of a medical foundation, if you could talk a little bit about the organization first.
That'd be great. Thank you. Yeah, it's actually a great question. In California, and I believe Texas, there are laws about hospital systems and their relationships with physicians. So in California, a hospital system cannot directly employ a physician unless it's an academic or it is a safety net. So not-for-profit hospital systems like Sutter Health have to have a medical foundation, which provides three services: research, medical care, and education to the community. And we contract directly with for-profit medical groups. Kaiser Health does this, Common Spirit does this, Sutter does this, as well as any other not-for-profit, Sharp included, Scripts.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, so thank you. Thank you for that. And can you tell the audience a little bit about your professional background and some of the steps in your career to bring you to this point of being CEO and president?
Sure. So I'm a nurse. I started off my nursing career in the emergency room, spent 10 years there. And really, I think at that point, realized that in the emergency department, most of what you're seeing are errors in care. Errors because patients didn't understand how to take care of themselves, or the health system wasn't prepared to provide the care that they needed. And so I became very interested in how could we provide better care. I did some leadership in the hospital and case management, and worked at a health plan briefly, got my master's in business, and then had the opportunity to work at Sutter Health and the Palo Alto Medical Foundation, which was really providing exceptional care. And the main reason why I chose that job, because I had other people trying to recruit me, was my boss at the time, Dr. David Hooper. He talked about our need to provide an exceptional patient experience that was high quality and patient-centered. And he was a physician talking to a nurse about that. So I thought, I've got to go to work at this organization. And throughout the last 18 years, I've just been so impressed with the physicians that I've worked with, et cetera, the leaders, and really centering on the patient, centering on high quality care. So it's just been a joy the last 18 years. Challenging, albeit, but a real joy.
Yeah. Well, important challenges. And I guess that's part of what brings the joy, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, 2020 has been, I mean, speaking of challenges, we have had new challenges on top of challenges. So I was wondering if you could share, Teresa, you know, how some of the previous work that you've done related to lean and continuous improvement helped prepare you and the organization for COVID-19 and other things that had to be figured out here in 2020.
It's a great question. So in 2014, I was the chief operating officer of Sutter Medical Foundation, which is, there are two foundation models that report up to me, Sutter Medical Foundation and Sutter Gould Medical Foundation. We hired our first director of lean. And Sutter Gould Medical Foundation had been on the journey about 3 or 4 years longer than us. So we were looking at how they were really changing their organization. And we have really since then invested in our frontline. We believe in humility when it comes to leadership, because the people doing the work need to solve the problems. What we need to do as leaders is provide them the tools and the learning to be capable so that as a learning organization, we respond to the frontline, we receive their feedback and change. A few years ago, we actually started working with Value Capture on going deep on real-time problem solving and safety. And so we had been on that journey for a year or two, I think 2 years, when COVID came in. And so our investment in learning our investment in understanding what it was to lead, which was to really step back and let the front line lead, really created a unique ability for us to not only respond to COVID, but to recover from COVID. And so we really very quickly changed the organization and adapted. But we relied on the front line. We trusted that the front line could help in the response and the recovery. They trusted us because we learned how to listen. We learned how to be there. We knew we needed to be in the Gemba round, look to see, look to solve the problems, help them solve the problems. So it really, I think, helped us tremendously. The culture that we have is really the reason why we're sitting where we are today.
Mm. Well, that's great to hear. And I'd like to kind of explore some of that a little bit more deeply. Can you talk about some of the things that had to be figured out? Both, I think, things the public or non-clinicians like myself might be, aware of, figuring out isolation and rethinking many aspects of care. What were some of the other changes that you had to deal with, and maybe some that general public might not be so aware of? And I guess I'm thinking in terms of context, you're not dealing with this in a hospital setting, so that's different.
Yeah. No. So thank you again. That's a great question. It's one that I've gotten from my friends as well. I think the first thing that everybody needs to understand that's not in that isn't sitting in the bubble called healthcare is that this was an emerging science. This was as complex as you can get. We were seeing what was happening first in China and then Europe, and so there was a certain amount of fear of what's going to happen next. And I would say that on March 3rd, I was less concerned, and on March 4th, I was very concerned. And it was evolving that quickly in California. And so it was something that we have never seen in my career. And I've been in nursing and in healthcare for 34 years. And so we had to look at things differently. The hospital really had a focus on isolation and treatment. For us, we had to actually figure out we have to continue to give care. Mm-hmm. The complexity of what we do every day in our clinics is extremely difficult to turn off. It would harm patients, and it has harmed patients, for them not to continue to get their chemotherapy, mm-hmm. for them not to get their lab tests, to not get their medications, to not see their doctor. And what was really difficult about this one is we knew that the most vulnerable patients were the ones that had the greatest fear. We went from having average daily clinic visits across the valley of about 20,000 every day on March 10th. That first little speck of COVID that was coming into California before they had the shelter in place, 10 days later, we would be down to a volume of 9,000. So when you start seeing that the patients who you typically see in a clinic with diabetes and heart failure and oncology, all of these patients are afraid and they're isolated, you had to respond very quickly. And I feel very fortunate and very humbled, actually, to work with the team I work with, because it was incredible. We relied on really understanding, I think I mentioned this, Mark, the real-time problem solving. And so we had to first put a new front door on our clinics. We had to expand video very quickly. And we had to divide up the leadership and go deep in the organization for problem solving. Mm-hmm. So first, we had to make things safe. It was all about safety. By March 6th, we knew we've got to have all of these things in place within a week. The school district started closing that weekend. The largest one in California, in Elk Grove, closed. On Monday morning, I had a leadership call. And I think I remember walking outside my clinic, my office where I have it, and I walking around the parking lot thinking, how can I deliver a message about I don't know, but I have confidence in all of you? Mm-hmm. And that was the message on March 10th. We hadn't seen the significant drop in the volume that the Bay Area had, and we knew it was coming at us. And so I got on a call with director levels and MEV on the medical group side, on the clinic side, and said, I don't know how it's going to unfold, but it's no longer business as usual. Mm-hmm. We're going to cancel all our leadership meetings. We are going to focus on safety. We need to keep you safe. We need to keep our patients safe. Right. And we need to continue care. So very different, very different. But what was interesting is everybody appreciated having having all of us say, this is very scary, and it's not like anything we've seen before.
Mm-hmm. And to me, what you're saying there is a great illustration of leading with humility, being willing to say, I'm kind of paraphrasing back to you, we don't know, but we'll work to figure it out together, and acknowledging the real reality of, you know, this is scary. There's a lot that's unknown, and helping people, you know, try to dive into that together. As you're saying, staff were scared too. I was wondering, you know, if you could share a little bit more about that dynamic, the two sides of it. What had to be figured out to, you know, the best you could alleviate some of the patient fears, and at the same time, you know, staff fears of people who are afraid to come to work, afraid to get sick.
Yeah, so there were really four areas that we focused on in the very beginning. It was personal protective equipment management. So we have incredible people in our supply chain. We had to secure the supplies, and we actually didn't know how to figure out the supply chain management and move away from just in time to today. You know, what's the clinic headcount? What's the staff headcount? And we relied on the front line. We said, we need this done, and they got it done. We needed for screening and advice. We had people coming in that had every symptom of COVID walking in our doors, not saying it before they got there. So all of a sudden we had to say, before you come in, we need you to call the advice line. We need to call your office. We had to rely on the physicians to make decisions on what needed to be postponed, from surgeries to in-office visits. And then for video, we had to get that up very quickly. Mm-hmm. We allowed, when we set up the telehealth, we really wanted physicians, you know, there were a few that really wanted to work from home, that were very afraid. And so we figured out how to, in a HIPAA compliant manner, get them to work from home. But once we put video in, it was a game changer. It was literally a game changer. And again, we have a at the elbow support team of, you know, these amazing coaches that are former medical assistants and patient service representatives, some nurses, and they were critical to getting the telehealth up. Once we got that up, I rounded about a week and a half later. Once we had enough PPE, I couldn't go out and round if I was going to use PPE that would mm-hmm. really the staff need, a patient needs, right? So when I went out and rounded, the fear was palpable. It was palpable among the physicians. The clinics looked really different, and you could see the patients when they came in. They wanted to see that we had changed our infection control practices, that we had done things to keep them safe. And our oncologist and others said that with the video, there were many patients that said, this is the only contact I'm having with the outside world. Mm-hmm. So they were socially isolated, and they so appreciated being able to see their physicians. I talked to a few physicians who have chronically ill children at home, and they were afraid about harming their family.
Right.
The real heroes in all of this story, and I think Rudy's focused on that, are the people that are on the front line that have had to adapt to changes that in the 10 years I worked in the emergency room, I talked to people, it got compressed into like 3 weeks, right? You're going to be in PPE all day long. You know, and for those of you who haven't, I've worn a mask all day long and gowns. It is physically draining. You have to figure out how to communicate with patients completely different. And our clinical teams have done it. You would not believe the compliments we get on a daily basis from our patients. And focusing on recovery, the three real-time problem-solving teams, one of them was about infection control. Mm-hmm. We actually started that on March 13th, which was the same week that we said, we don't know, you know, we've got to figure things out. And by March 20th, we had three problem-solving teams that went deep from CEO down to the front line, 40 or 50 people on in-person care, telehealth, and surgical recovery, because we essentially shut our surgery centers down. And how are we going to take care of all those things that need to be taken care of? Heart valve replacement. So these weren't simple procedures. How long can we postpone them? Mm-hmm. How quickly can we make it safe for them to come in? So it was, the courage on the front line was incredible. And you had to listen. And you had to see it. So going to Gemba was really important. And they also appreciated we were listening to them.
Yeah, I'm sure. Can you elaborate a little bit on, when you talk about real-time problem solving, you know, there may be people in the audience who've worked with value capture and are very familiar with that model, but I was wondering if you could share from your perspective, like what that process means, you know, maybe break it down, what makes it real time and what are some of the, you know, kind of approaches or structures that make it more effective problem solving?
Sure. So real-time problem solving is really clearly defining that problem. And then in the moment, getting very, and I'm talking very detailed. So Solano County did not have that much, significant amount of COVID at the time. On March 20th, when we only had 9,000, like less than 50% of our normal clinic volume, we found a place that was safe. We deployed a team and we said, how do we create 6 feet, 10 minutes? How do we create a pull from the car? Mm-hmm. So typically patients walk in, they wait in the waiting room. The waiting room is full of magazines. It's full of stuff that now we have to clean. So how do we create the cleaning? So we started that on March 20th and we had a huge team. They created it. They solved the problem for 6 and 10. They solved the problem for masking and arrival from the car. So the patients would text. They would get arrived and get pulled into the clinic visit. We would clean and they would leave. That spread through the month of April to over 100 locations. Hmm. And then by the end of April, beginning of May, we started auditing to make sure that in-person care was safe. And we sent out messages to our patients. It's going to look different and it's safe. Come see us. So by the first week of June, we had recovered probably 85% of our volume because we did real-time problem solving. I didn't say, go do this. The people who do the work went out and said, how long will it take for a patient to walk? How long will it take for us to clean? How quickly do we do this? So we've got, it's incredible to see again, how the frontline solve these problems.
Mm-hmm. And you know, you talked about, you know, the time spent building those capabilities and those habits. I was wondering, you know, if you could talk about some of the early stages of that cultural shift. You talk about leaders stepping back, as I've heard other people say, of, you know, not having as many top-down answers, that habit or old habits of, you know, giving answers can be hard to break. I've seen from a staff perspective, it can also be difficult for them because they're used to receiving answers. And now they're being engaged in a different way that can be exciting or scary or both.
It took years. When we first did Lean, when we first started, and we had great coaches, but I don't think we were listening and we weren't hearing. Mm-hmm. We were doing site visits to see what was going on. But we understood the concepts in a meaningful way. But when we went out to round, we were talking about, oh, let's look at the huddle board. Let's look at this. When we went deeper into real-time problem solving and daily engagement and investing there, really then what you start doing is you understand the questions you need to ask to understand the thinking. And we're still struggling with that, frankly, Mark, a little bit, because with everything with COVID, it became top down, right? Thou shalt wear a mask. You will be taking temperatures. And now we've got to switch back to bottom up. And so it's been really incredible to see the frontline respond. But had we been still having to direct traffic, we would not be where we are. We would have had more exposures. We would have had a lot more things that were unsafe, but our focus was safety, respect for the front line, mm-hmm. and really seeing what the problems were, measuring them and solving them and having the front line solve them.
Yeah. Wow. So that's really good to hear. I mean, that's a powerful endorsement of that model, even during very challenging times. And
yeah.
Yeah. What I hear you saying is, you know, there's still a time and a place where maybe, you know, time or speed was of the urgency and some things had to be mandated.
Yeah. We could only have one nursing protocol.
Yeah.
That the senior infectious disease specialist helped us with. And we had to change that almost weekly because of all of the changing science. We couldn't have, you know, the 2,000 physicians in the Valley and clinicians decide that each one of them would have their own nursing protocol. Yeah. We had to have one. So there were things like that, that the science and the safety necessitated rapid setup and tight control. And when you have to have tight control over process, you have to reduce the variation. That's pretty much what we had to do.
Yeah. And, like to me, I mean, I think part of the mindset shift is where, you know, you find the balance. If the old default had been almost everything top down, I think even within a lean culture, it doesn't necessarily swing 180 degrees in the other direction, but that top down maybe becomes the exception when there are special circumstances. And it sounds like in some aspects of this, that was very true.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because, you know, I'm thinking back to, I went and pulled up a quote, like, you know, one of my mentors had sort of expressed, like, even, you know, back to more of a traditional manufacturing setting, which is, of course, very different than healthcare. Yeah. But the phrase, and I wanted to quote it directly, was that, you know, you need unity in the essential and liberty in the non-essential. And I'm reminded of that because, like you were saying, there are certain things where it was so essential, really a matter of safety, it had to be done a certain way.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
I love that quote. That's a perfect one.
Yeah. And doing so doesn't necessarily then cut off the input and the engagement and the problem solving that's required in parallel to that.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. A good example is, you know, when you're in so many different locations, we have small clinics where we have three providers and one desk that's an arrival. They have to solve the problem for safe patient care. I can't, the MOB that's down the road, medical office building that has 80 clinicians, they're going to have a different solution. And so to your point, you have to customize based on what the patients need and the care teams need.
Mm-hmm. So one other, or a couple other challenges, you know, that came up here in 2020, as if, you know, COVID-19 was not enough, especially in California and especially in Northern California, the challenges of wildfires, social unrest and protests and other things going on in the community. How did you help address those as situations as a leader, and how did you engage staff in problem solving there?
Yeah, well, thank you for that question. We'll talk about the social unrest first, and because subsequent to that, the wildfires came. Mm-hmm. So over the last weekend of May, there were a lot of, there were peaceful protests mixed with some violent protests in the greater Sacramento area. In many different communities that we serve, and our clinics are sitting in these areas where there was social unrest. On Monday, June 1st, I was informed by one of the CEOs that we had been contacted. It was right around noon, and we were in a kind of COVID recovery because we were just starting to recover. And we had just been informed that there was expected social unrest to the extent of violence that was expected that evening. And because of that, we had to close our clinics early. Our clinics typically in some locations go well past 5 o'clock or 7. They wanted us out of there between 3 and 5. So we stopped what we were doing related to COVID. We spent the next 8 hours because we said we're going to have to plan for the week. This is not going to go away tonight.
Right.
And we were partnering with local law enforcement, but our focus again went to safety. We needed to make sure our patients were safe, our staff were safe, our clinicians were safe. And then we had to plan if there was physical destruction of a clinic, we did not want staff going in there in the morning. We did not want staff responding to any alarms that went off. So we spent literally the next 8 hours, and then we had late leadership calls. We got everybody on the phone that needed to get on the phone in the areas where there was unrest. And we said, this is the standard work. And the next day, you know, I openly admitted, I haven't been through this before. I had been through wildfires. I've now been through a pandemic. And emotionally, it was taxing. So we responded with safety. And then by the end of the week, I sat down with my leadership team, our leadership team, I don't see it as mine, and we reflected on the emotional toll of all of this. Mm-hmm. And we took a pause. I had this whole strategy retreat planned for that day, 8 hours, social distancing, on video, all of that. And I just said, it's going to be a few hours. In the first hour, we're going to talk about what's happening. What does this mean to us? And it was it was almost like a pause. And then we set up Better Together forums, and it's being led again by our diversity and inclusion team, but it's the front line leading it. It's people coming in together to have conversations. And then the wildfires happen. And so that was, again, physically draining because you couldn't go outside and you couldn't breathe. However, we've been through wildfires before. And so we had great facilities team. We have great leadership on the front line. We had people who were being evacuated from their homes and also responding in clinics. I've been evacuated before, and it's mentally unsettling to be somewhere doing work where you've got this split mind of, am I going to be able to go back? Am I going to get harmed? Those kinds of things. It's just draining. But I give it kudos to the Sutter Health System. They did an amazing job. And then what was really cool, the silver lining out of the wildfires. We got portable HEPA filters, or not HEPA filters, but we got portable air processing. We're now using those for our respiratory clinics because they process the air quick enough to make it safe for us to bring our respiratory clinics inside. Because through the COVID in March, we had cold, cold, rainy weather. And in the summer, we had over 100 degree temperatures. So we had to monitor the temperatures of the staff. So now, again, silver lining, we got that. But yeah, I'd say it's been a challenging year. And again, the care teams have been incredible. And the patients have been really very thankful, but also incredible, very patient with us as we've changed things.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, for being a challenging year, you know, it's encouraging to hear of, you know, some of the, of making the best of the situation and, you know, engaging people in a way where you know, the organization is coping better than what it might have otherwise. And, you know, there's still a lot to go through. You know, this challenge is not done, but I'm sure that creativity and that problem solving and that spirit will continue.
Yeah, no, I can't tell you how thankful I am to be working with the teams I am. They're the ones that are solving the problems. And again, really hats off to them, the front line.
Yeah. Well, I think it's great to give recognition to them. So thank you for doing that. And we'll certainly do what we can to amplify that praise that's well-deserved to you know, people in your organization and people elsewhere. So other than saying thank you for that, I don't know what else to add. It's good to hear.
Well, no, I appreciate the conversation and appreciate the time to help share a perspective from a very challenging year.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your leadership and for sharing what you've been doing, Teresa. You know, I think we hope podcasts like this are, you know, informative and inspiring to other leaders and other developing leaders who aren't yet in a role like you're in now. So, you know, thank you. Thank you for sharing, you know, thinking through that and sharing those reflections on this challenging year, Teresa.
Great, Mark. Thanks.
So thank you. Our guest again has been Teresa Fry, CEO and president of Sutter Medical Foundation. We certainly wish the best to you and to your team and your patients and your community.
Great, Mark. Have a nice day.
Thanks for listening to Habitual Excellence presented by Value Capture. We hope you'll subscribe to the podcast and please also rate and review it in your favorite podcast directory or app. To learn more about Value Capture and how we can help your organization on this journey to habitual excellence, visit our website at www.valuecapturellc.com.